Welcome to everyone to this in conversation we're having with Dr. Yi Yu on China's new role in global economic governance. Dr. Yi Yu is from the Shanghai Institute for International Studies. Dr. Yi is an associate professor and assistant director at the Department for World Economy Studies at SWIS. And her research is focused on global economic governance and China's role. She has done a lot of work on the proposed BRICS Bank. Yu has been visiting us for the last couple of weeks. We've been very lucky to have her here. She has also been down to Canberra to talk to academics and policymakers up there, down there or up there, depending on one's point of view, I guess, and also has been up to Brisbane. Lowy joins a prestigious list of institutions that Dr. Yi has visited, such as Yale University and the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Leon Berkelmans. I am the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. Dr. Yi will talk for about 10 to 20 minutes on China's new role in economic governance, and then we'll open up to the floor for questions. So I'll hand over to Dr. Yi.
Thank you very much, Leon. And thank you for everybody coming and participating in this conversation. I'm so honored to be able to be here, have this kind of open conversation with you. As Leon said, I'm going to talk on the topic of China's new rule in global economic governance. So how new it is, I guess it's something that you expect me to answer. I will basically talk on three points. The first, I will say a few words about how to understand China's position in the world economic system. So what is its status, what is interests? And the second point, based on the first one, I will come to the second point, actually more about how to understand how China's position in the world economy system shape its rule in the global economic governance. Including its new Belt and Road initiatives in that. And the third point, elaborate more on its approach on China's rule. So let me start with the first point, how to understand China's position in the world economic system. Let me give you the short answer first. It is big, but it is still weak, not strong. And what do I mean by big? I guess most of you know it is a very big economy. So just some very easy numbers. Since 1787, for three decades, it grew at 9.8% every year. So that is spectacular growth. And after that, now the GDP has already arrived at more than $10 trillion. So it is only second to the United States, about 12th of the world total. And its GDP and its trade, it's more than $4 trillion. It's the largest in the world, so more than the United States. Also, a little bit more than 12% of the world total. And its foreign exchange reserves, that's also very significant, more $4 trillion. And it's about one-third of the world total. And its carbon emission, of course, it's number one in the world. Also, probably one-third of the world. And it's FDI. I forgot the FDI after the trade. It's outflow. It's inward FDIs already being largest of the all the developing countries. But now it's FDIs, the outflow of the FDI is growing very fast. It has already the annual flow last year is more than 100 billion, only second to the United States. So the last population, don't forget it. It's every 5 people in the world, there's one Chinese, okay? So yes, from all of this data, you can see China is very big, so very influential. Everybody is interested in it. But on this other hand, it is still not strong. It is weak. I can also show you some more structural facts on its economy, such as trade. When I say it's weak, basically I'm talking on its two key elements. One is technology, the other is finance. That is two weakest points of the Chinese economy in its structure. And on the trade, I said it's the largest trading power, but in terms of the domestic value added, that is a indicator to show really really how much money you earn. Really, it's only second to India, lowest in the G20 members. So and it's lower than the average. It's only 67% value added that is generated domestically in China. So China is basically an assembling center, and everybody knows that China has fast speed train, right? But it has a German heart. It's the key part, the key component is imported from Germany. And finance. China has the largest foreign exchange reserves. It has very high saving rate. But why does it save so much dollar and so much RMB, not spend it? Because it needs to, it doesn't have a strong currency internationally compared with the dollar. So it needs to accumulate this kind of insurance to prevent from external financial risks. So this is a dollar trap, people call it. And the last one probably why it's still not strong, it's a highest level. That is about the international economic rule. China is basically a follower, not a leader in making rules. That's probably the most fundamental point. And so let's conclude on the first point. China is very big, and but structurally, it's still relatively weak. And it's a systematically important economy in the world. It has its own policy has enormous spillover effect, but also it faces very enormous challenges inside domestically. Chinese people face survival issue. It cannot afford clean air. So not like everybody here, you are very lucky. And we have also inequality problem, and also longer term, even population, the labor cost kind of rising. So the Chinese finance minister himself said there's 50% of chance, possibility that China may be trapped in the middle income trap. So that's so we have very kind of a very well aware of the problems, from the government officials to citizens I myself can feel this kind of challenges we face. So based on the first point, it's big but weak. This will define what kind of role it can play and should play in the world. So China faces very high expectation from the world. But as I said, it is not that strong enough yet. So to look at the role of Chinese engagement with the global economic system, I would say it's a kind of, we are in a transitionary period, which is characteristic of a kind of coexistence of both strength and weakness, both ambition and ambiguity. So based on this point, very shortly, I will elaborate as my third point of my presentation today. What do I mean by a kind of both ambition and ambiguity? From this following points. First, it is a globally developing country, so it is very deeply integrated in the global economic system. So it needs to do something globally, but the main priorities is actually to lead through bilateral and regional initiatives. The reason is very simple. It cannot revive the WTO overnight by itself. It cannot change the US Congress to approve the IMF reform package. So it just cannot simply revive those global institutions by itself overnight. What it can do more realistically, more practically, is to do it through bilateral and regional initiatives. So it's kind of taking a circle to play some leadership. And this is what the Belt and Road Initiative actually is basically about. It's not a legal framework. It is not a global FTA or whatever. It's kind of a case by case, bilateral and regional. So it's a concept and not very clear defined strategically. Not to define it first, but we can just put many initiatives in the under the concept and do it. And so that's the first point one for its approach to go through not only global but also bilateral and regional. And secondly, what is its approach? I mean, China has risen basically as a trading power. So its trade strategy used to be its focus. So I always say, when I was a student, everybody is studying WTO. So that is the case. But today, as I said, China's trade agenda probably now is at a kind of stalemate, because on the one hand, the developed countries, they want China to give more market access in the service market, especially. I said China is a large trading power, but it's trade in commodity, in goods, not in services. So, and on the other hand, the developing countries, they are not willing to give more market access because of China. They thought China is too competitive. So why should we give you more market access? So China is kind of in the sandwiched condition. So whether China is developing country or developed country, it is both. So there's a professor from Tsinghua University, Li Daokui. He said the world is now composed of three parts: developing countries, developed countries, and China. So China is a sandwiched position, actually, in the traditional trade agenda. It cannot give the market access as the United States want. And it should do something to help the developing countries, to give some asymmetric concessions for other developing countries to really enhance common interests. So the solution for China is to expand its agenda from the traditional trade to a more comprehensive one. That is what the bank is about. Also one, the other reason is because of its comparative advantage. As I said, China has the largest forex exchange reserves, but the reserves are losing money every day. It's put in the U.S. bonds. So how to shift the investment of the foreign exchange reserves from the U.S. bonds to real economy, to really finance the poor people, not the rich people in the United States. So that is a long-term strategy. So based on the two reasons I have listed, one, stalemate in the trade agenda. Second, how to use its foreign exchange reserves more efficiently, more productively. So these basic two basic reasons shaped the shift of its strategy from a trade-focused one to a more comprehensive one. Yes, we are still doing FTA with many people, like we have just signed the FTA with Australia. But on the other hand, the priority seems to be shifted to the financial diplomacy. I'm sure you have learned about China has initiated the AIIB, that is a regional multilateral development banks focusing on infrastructure financing. And China also supported the BRICS, new development bank. I'm not sure whether you all have heard about it. BRICS is five countries: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So the five countries, they have leaders summit since 2009. And now in 2012, they started to study the possibility of establishing a new bank, and then it took 2 years to finalize the agreement. So the bank was already established. And these are two multilateral banks that China has initiated or supported. Both are located, are headquartered in China, one in Beijing, AIIB, and BRICS Bank, headquartered in Shanghai. So that's why Leon has introduced, because I'm from Shanghai, so do more work on that. So this is a second shift of its approach. And comparing to the trade agenda, the infrastructure financing projects are more about making cakes together, rather than only changing your regulations through the FTA about that. And the third point about the approach, I would say, there's coexistence of both ambition and ambiguity. So there's some ambition in trying to, in the international economic rule level, try to evolve from a follower to some kind of initiator or more proactive participant in that. And so this is a very broad topic. I would not go into details about how China is trying to more proactively participate in the, such as in the investment rulemaking. China is negotiating a bit with the United States bilateral investment treaty, and also in the bank, in the new bank, I've already mentioned how to make the bank run more efficiently than the World Bank. That's kind of also rulemaking. And the last point, the first point about the approach, I want to emphasize one point. All of these things done, because this is a question that many people ask me, so is it to challenge the United States in the regional order or the global order? Just to mention a little bit about it. I mean, it's not to challenge, because China has too much vested interest in the United States. As I said, it saves its money there. What's the reason for me to challenge you, okay? And also, it is not in a position to challenge yet. So it's better to say China wants to make its people live a better life. I like the Lois poll actually last week, coming out last week. I read that more than 70% of Australian people believe China its purpose is to create a better life for its own people, not to really challenge the order, because it has very huge vested interest in the existing system. So it's not in its own interest to challenge anything. So thank you very much.
Wonderful. So you mentioned the AIIB, and this was something that received a lot of headlines here in Australia, particularly the United States' attitude toward the AIIB. Now, I was in the United States in April, and I think it's fair to say that most Americans, most people I talk to in Washington, including Americans, think that the Americans completely mishandled the AIIB decision. I think there's a lot of regret on their behalf. Now, one of the benefits I heard of trying to bring China into the tent of global leadership is that if you do that, the Chinese will learn just how hard this gig is. So the AIIB now has 57 founding members. There's going to be negotiations and likely fights about what currency they use, what language they use. There's going to be fights about staffing and, you know, how many vice presidents, who are they, that kind of thing. Do you think that the Chinese are aware of the challenges that await them in this realm? Or do you think that there are some big lessons to learn?
Of course, thank you for your question. Yes, of course. China definitely is very well aware how many challenges there are. China knows very well taking leadership needs to pay for taking leadership. It needs to pay not only money. Probably paying money is the easiest thing. It's much more difficult to provide more entrepreneurship leadership and intellectual leadership, and how to really negotiate with all these stakeholders to make decision based on consensus rather than its veto power. So that's basically more difficult. There are so many stakeholders, so many interests behind that. So it's kind of a difficult issue. I'm interested you mentioned that there's not only talk about which currency to use. That's an issue that has been discussed so much. But I don't think language discussion will be a problem. I don't think AIB will talk in Chinese. So if we look at the world, yes, it's the largest number of people speaks Chinese. But English is an international language, not Chinese. It's the first international language. So probably more competition, more debates in AIIB will be which currency and also what kind of presidents you mentioned, and also more than that, how to finance. Because AIIB needs to, it's only like 20% is really paid in capital. So how to finance the other 80% from the capital market? It's difficult to get a 3A rating from the rating agencies. So its finance cost will be a little bit higher than the World Bank. And also where to invest, what to invest. All these are very difficult issues to deal with. I mean, it's a bank. It's not a ODA. It's not a grant. So it's not a subsidy. So how to make the bank financially sustainable and also to really beneficial for the country that receives the money. So it's like walking on the rope. It's a very risky business. It needs to take care of interests of all the members, all the sides, to really, and also needs to take care of the interests of the community to be socially accountable. So there are enormous challenges there. But I think fortunately, it's a really multilateral one compared to the BRICS Bank. AIIB is much more multilateral and international. Its negotiation process and its drafting of the agreement are all international, very open one. So I'm sure, including Australia and also European countries, they are more experienced in doing the multilateral banks. So I would hope the co-leadership deal with the challenges together is more important. And I guess look at the strategic implications of the bank. It's more than making cake. It's also about making peace. That's a point that I want to stress. I mean, to increase the trust. Actually, why so many European countries, including Australia, let me very frankly talk about this point. Join the bank. Actually, the first point is to let's be one member inside to influence China. So still kind of suspicion behind, kind of motivation. But I think that's very normal because China has never played very big role in other areas. So how to play the institution's game? AIIB is like a test. So to enhance trust at the end. So we cannot afford a failure of the bank. Thank you.
Now you also mentioned the BRICS Bank, which is actually your area of specialty, but I think it's fair to say that in Australia, AIIB has grabbed more headlines than the BRICS Bank. Could you just quickly tell us a little bit about the BRICS Bank? What's it for? Where's the money going to go? How is it different to the AIIB?
Yes. BRICS Bank, it only has five shareholders now, the five BRICS countries I have already mentioned. And its size, its authorized capital is the same as AIIB. It's $100 billion. But only half of it has been subscribed by the five BRICS, which means there's other $50 billion capital base open to the other countries. So Australia, if interest, still can join in the BRICS bank, if possible, and including all the other developed and developing countries. And its mandate is a tricky issue. Although I said the agreement has been signed, but the agreement is basically a framework. It basically says the bank could its purpose is to finance infrastructure and sustainable development in BRICS countries and all the developing countries. So what's that? It's a World Bank. It's a small World Bank. So its mandate needs to be much better clearly defined. Otherwise, the bank will go nowhere. It cannot be a World Bank at this moment. And compared with the AIIB, its funding, its capital is more limited. I mean, so it needs to, it or for its paid in capital is 20%, which means $10 billion paid, real paid in at the launching period in 7 installments. So it will start operation at the end of this year or early next year. So it's at the starting period, its capital is really limited. And so how to find its niche market is also a challenge. And compared to AIIB, it's the difference. Actually, the BRICS bank came first before AIIB. AIIB, I would say, was kind of inspired by the BRICS bank, although the BRICS bank's idea was given by Americans, and AIIB is Chinese own idea, but it's inspired a little bit by the BRICS bank before that. If AIIB, as I said, is not only about making cake and making peas, the BRICS bank is more about making cake, less about making peas because of its cross-regional nature. And so what else about the BRICS bank? There's too many to say. challenges. I want to talk, we are focusing on the challenges. In addition to the capital base, and also the where to invest and what sector, whatever. There's a challenge of how to unite the five BRICS countries, how to unite them to make the cake together. So that's something that China really should do more on that. So let me stop here.
Sure, thank you very much. I'm going to ask one more question and then I'll throw it over to the audience. So please think of your questions. So at Lowy we house the G20 Study Centre. And so the G20 is very close to our heart. We had the presidency last year. China will be coming up to take the presidency off Turkey come November. And I think it's fair to say the world is really looking at this moment with a great deal of interest. What do you think China would like to achieve during its G20 presidency?
Okay, thank you very much. What would China to achieve? I think the first thing China wants to achieve for the G20 is to keep the G20 more relevant. it does not want to destroy the G20 in its presidency. And actually China has already been mobilized, fully mobilized for this purpose. It is already one member of the Troika mechanism. Australia, Turkey, and China, the three countries are already working together as a Troika. So China is already providing inputs to the G20 agenda. And what China wants to achieve for the world, I mean, the G20's agenda has kind of evolved from managing crisis to promoting growth. So from stability-based to a kind of growth-based. And next year, I would probably expect, because of this year, there are two major events on development. One is the global climate negotiation in Paris in December, and the other is the post-2015 development cooperation. The United Nations is coming up with a document. So next year, I would expect the third pillar of the G20, stability, growth, and development. In the past several years, we've already seen development issues being discussed, but piece by piece, like gender issues have been coming out. But next year, probably would expect more systemic discussions how to put this grand development documents into implementation more systematically. So G20 could probably do more on that, but it depends on what kind of results this year we can achieve. And another perspective about what China expect from the G20, China would expect the G20 also enhance its own domestic agenda. I mean, basically about in the Belt and Road Initiative, there is one word I really like. That is to align the Belt and Road Initiative with the other countries' domestic agenda. So the alignment, the word is actually borrowed from the OECD's DAC, Development Assistance Committee. They put the alignment as a basic principle to enhance development effectiveness. So I would think the G20 provides a perfect chance for China to align its own domestic agenda with the global agenda. So that would be a great thing. I mean, it's because we are facing a very fragmented global order. And China is a major power. When it talks about G20, we need to link it to its domestic agenda to reduce the fragmentation. So G20 is a perfect chance.
Wonderful.
I also hope G20 can make President Xi better known in Australia. I learned that, also read from the poll, more than 50% of Australian people does not know who President Xi Jinping is. So that's really, really surprising for me.
It was surprising for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah.
And thank you for referring to the Lowy poll a couple of times. That's great publicity. So I'll throw it open to the floor. Could I just ask that you first introduce yourself quickly, who you are, where you are from, and a question I have been told has two excellent characteristics. A good question has two characteristics. One is that it's short, and the second is that it ends with a question mark. So, if we could keep to those rules, I think this will be great. So, who is first? I've scared everyone off with those. We've got a question down here. There's a microphone coming around.
Cameron Kogo from IAG. One question I had for you is, one thing observed by a lot of commentators is the challenges China faces in moving from more production-based to consumption-based. And I'm just wondering, what are your views on China making that shift? Because compared to even other emerging market economies, if you will, it does seem to be much more geared towards the production focus.
Okay, thank you very much. I will first give my answer to it, but I think I also the Leo is more qualified to answer this question. So let me give my opinions first. Yes, there's a lot of discussions about the transformation from investment based. From its economy, from product investment based to consumption based. My personal assessment is that first, the shift has not achieved so much yet. Actually, we talked about this issue. We have seen a little bit rise of the consumption, the share of the consumption, the ratio of the consumption in terms of GDP, a little bit higher than the investment, but I doubt it's really any great achievement. Actually, the housing price has constrained consumption of the ordinary people a lot. So, you know that China has the rising inequality for those rich people. They don't really contribute to the rise of the consumption yet. So the middle class, the rise of the middle class, we haven't seen any momentum in it yet. And if you look at it more carefully about how China is doing its growth strategy, because growth is still a very high priority because of the employment. It needs to provide more jobs for those young people and for those people immigrating from rural areas to the cities. Look at those policies still focusing on investment, probably more quality investment in the middle and in the western parts. This because don't forget China is a very diversified country, and different provinces there are very huge gaps. So in the middle part and in the western part, still there are rooms for more investment, just to make those investment more sustainable, so higher standards for it. But still, investment is still the first solution to enhance its growth. And that's my first point. And my second point, I would say that I doubt whether the ratio of the consumption and investment in terms of GDP is the best indicator to measure Chinese economic transformation or industrial upgrading. I agree with people saying that probably the productivity is more relevant indicator. China, if look at its comparative advantages at this moment, it's not necessary because it has a large manufacturing base. And we need to respect this kind of dependence of path its existing structure. So how to make this production more efficient? Probably it's more important, not only the ratio of the GDP. If just look at the ratio of the consumption in terms of GDP, we can become the Latin American countries. They have high ratio of the consumption, but it doesn't necessarily, they are still in middle income trap. So how to enhance innovation and technology, that is probably more important. So more professional answer will come from Leo.
I'll do my best, but you've done exceptionally well there. Look, I'll keep my answer short because today's not really about me. But so I think that China does have to move away to some extent from its current model of growth. So I think that this is most clear in terms of residential construction overall. I used to work at the Reserve Bank, and we did some work when I was at the Reserve Bank projecting out residential construction in China for 20 or 30 years, which generally is a mug's game, but we thinking out that far, but we did our best. And we came to the conclusion that, well, construction in China does look like it's pinned down by fundamentals. The amount that they're building does look like it's being pinned down by fundamentals. That's income growth and urbanisation. But the growth in residential construction is just about over. That it's going to remain at a very high level, so they're still going to be building plenty of apartments, but the growth coming from that looks like it's over. So I think it's a fair argument, it's a good argument, and an argument I think is right, that China has to move away from a sort of construction and manufacturing centred economy to one more built on services. That will probably lead to some fall in GDP growth. For one reason is just that, for whatever reason, productivity growth in construction and manufacturing is less than in services. It's just a statistical regularity we see. We perhaps don't understand it well, but that's the way it is. On the other hand, there are lots of reforms that the Chinese can do in services, lots of liberalisation that can perhaps boost GDP growth. There was an excellent book by one of my favourite economists on China, Nick Lardy, who published a book earlier this year talking about how there's real potential for unlocking a lot of growth in some of the services sectors that the government still dominates. And he's a very long time China watcher. I've got a great deal of respect for him. And he's actually very bullish about Chinese growth if they can do that. He actually thinks that perhaps China can grow at 8% for the next 5 to 10 years if they get the policies right. I'm maybe a little bit more sceptical of that, but like I say, Nick Lardy knows what he's talking about. One other issue is, sorry, you'll be next. One other issue is the Chinese don't necessarily care about GDP growth, they care about jobs. And services is more labour intensive, so they can grow at a lower level and still be a giant jobs factory. So enough from me. I think we have a question there up the back.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to ask a question about rural ownership of land. What is the situation in China now on rural farm ownership in your country?
Actually, you are asking about land reform, right? I'm probably not very good at giving you a satisfactory answer. There's a lot of movements there. I mean, as you know, that land is a public asset in China, and the farmers have only the right to use. I mean, and this basic structure has not changed, but there's more room for peasants to transfer their rights. So this is actually, I'm from the rural area, and my neighborhood, I saw there are actually Many farmers, they moved to cities, so their houses were they were purchased by companies. So there's kind of movement there, but I cannot give you more details. I haven't followed these very specific issues very consistently, but
I can yeah, just jump in with a quick anecdote. So I was at the weekend before last. I was in Chongqing for the annual Chinese Economist Society meetings, and we were treated to an unscheduled hour-long talk by Chongqing mayor, this is actually the successor to Bo Xilai, on the Chongqing economy. When we were actually told by the moderator that we were very unlucky because the mayor last week had given a three-hour talk, and we were very lucky not to receive that three-hour talk. But the point is that he talked a little bit about land reform. And so in China, a lot of this stuff is done in a decentralized manner, right? So it's done experimentally, different pockets, and he was talking about the kinds of things that were going on in Chongqing. So I didn't quite understand all the details, but they've got land tickets at the moment. So I think my understanding of what he was talking about was that in Chongqing, in the municipality of Chongqing, rural holders can somehow exchange some of their land for an apartment in the city or a house in the city. So there are slow reforms. The Chinese tend to do things very slowly. There are slow reforms, I think, in order to deal with some of the issues that there are in rural areas.
But I just add one point about that. The key issue is what you give to those farmers for their land rights. That's a key issue. I think many arrangements are not satisfactory to farmers, so they are very cautious to give up their rights. Or that's still.
Tony Berg, I'm a business person. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Yi. Very much appreciate it. You mentioned that China is big but weak, but it's clearly big enough for the international economy to worry about what happens in China. You know, we used to say that when the US sneezes, the rest of us catch a cold. I think, particularly in Australia, if China were to sneeze, Australia would certainly catch a cold. And in that context, I mean, it is difficult to understand really what's going on in some areas. I mean, for example, there's talk about property bubble and whether the bubble might burst. There's talk about the stability of the banking system and how many bad loans there are within the banking system. And so my question is transparency. One of the things, if China is to play a major role in the world, you know, when will we get greater transparency on what is really going on from an economics point of view? Thank you.
So it's a political economy issue. Yes, I agree with you that how to get the world is concerned about how Chinese economy is going and wants to know more about the real facts, what is going on. I would say that transparency is, this term looks like a very sensitive political issue. But I would say actually it's more than that. It's first a technical kind of capacity issue. The how to do the data, how to compare the data with the international one. That is kind of, it needs a lot of people, skills and knowledge to do that. Don't overestimate Chinese government officials. Basically, for many data, like energy, because I ever talked to people from IEA, I asked the question, how do you look at the Chinese data on energy? Is it because China not willing to give their data, or they are just not able to give it? And their answer is mainly actually both, but mainly some for many data, they're just not able to provide it. I think this applies to the general sectors, to all the sectors on that. But there's good news. In last year's G20, actually in Australia's G20 presidency, China made a commitment to accept the IMF's standard to report its data, economic data. So there's progress there. And in addition to the capacity, and also there is indeed some political sensitivity, such as like it's still energy, like energy security. Probably some there is some concern whether it's related to my national security or it's because sometimes to like the also like ODA, there's a lot of complaints about China does not have comparable data with the world. So but I think that still this aspect is less important now. China has a more open mind with this if it wants to engage with the world, because its own economy is more and more integrated in the world system. And this is second point. I would say I would a little bit broaden your question about the transparency to more communication problem probably between China and the world. It's a broader issue, but I think this is very relevant. For communication issues, such as I found, although we have so many direct flights, like China and the U.S. has more than almost 100 channels between governments to communicate, but still so many misunderstandings, misperceptions behind. So there's reasons, and cultural difference, languages really contribute to this kind of problems, I would say. So my suggestion is actually probably the solution is not only in the government level how to enhance dialogues and whatever. I think the gap in the civil society communication, like think tanks. I think we are more we should do more in explaining what China is going, how China is now. This is something that the government cannot really do much. So we should play a bigger role in enhancing transparency of the whole society, economy, and whatever. And actually, just to add to the question of the G20, G20 is also a good platform to enhance the think tanks communications. That's basically why I'm here.
Hi, my name is Nick Hudson. I'm from Infrastructure Partnerships Australia. My question is in regards to the AIIB and how you think it will, operate on the ground on a project level basis compared to other multi-level development banks. Just presuming that the ultimate structure of, say, something around procurement could potentially influence if the AIIB chooses, either Chinese SOEs or it chooses firms from other advanced economies. So just curious how I look on the ground.
Is the question especially about things like procurement? Is that the particular?
Compared to other multilateral development banks, how it will operate on the ground, how it will be different, how they choose firms to deliver projects, for instance.
So it's lending policies, safeguards.
Yeah, those kind of things too. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me focus on some points because it involves so many things.
Let's just try and keep it brief as well because we're supposed to finish very soon.
Yes.
So wonderful.
I will just focus on the one, procurement. Second, safeguard. Okay. For the procurement, it's already done. It will be open procurement policy, not protective. By the way, BRICS Bank does have a protective procurement policy. And second, the safeguard issue. Safeguard issue is the agreement has, I haven't seen the agreement, and it's not, it will be, I don't think it is going to, it will have safeguard policy because there's even doubt that whether it will have one or at all. And for environment and the social safeguard, as the BRICS Bank, I would suggest that actually to look at the Chinese domestic context. That is better to understand how the AIIB is going. The Chinese domestic is improving a lot on this perspective. I mean, the banking regulatory committee has come out with the policies to enhance their standards on that. And I would say more important is to look at the domestic context of the countries that will receive the money, how to improve their own domestic regulatory environment. That's something that AIIB can do. And but compared to the World Bank and ADB, I would expect AIIB is not to just follow their practice. I mean, so I would say AIIB, I agree that is to create the best practice, not to follow any. There's no uniform standard on the multilateral development banks. And the World Bank has been actually reviewing its own safeguard policy, how to make it more efficient, how to reduce those very redundant procedures, like going to hospitals, doing so many, just a waste of time, and also those kind of standards that is not relevant to the development, but more about political system or whatever. And just give you a simple example to show what I mean, such as the World Bank sometimes is more kind of under the pressure of the NGO. They are kind of abandoning all the fossil fuel energy projects because of the concern of the environment. So they are kind of absolute environmentalism. That is a kind of one-size-fits-all solution. Think about those poor countries. Can they really afford the renewable energy solution all the time? Sometimes very high efficient clean energy is also good. So that's an example to show. Probably AIIB can improve some a little bit to get really efficient. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. So that concludes today's event. Thank you very much for coming and hope to see you back here again soon. Thank you very much.